Heather Boucher, and I'm from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And I would just like to welcome all of you here on this lovely Friday morning. This is the fourth of a series that we're doing on work and family briefings, and it's just very exciting to see all of you here today. I'm going to turn it over very quickly to Lindsay from Representative Woolsey's office. I'm just made her a senator there to give an introduction to the panel. Thank you.
Good morning. As Heather said, this briefing is the fourth in a series of five that has highlighted the challenges facing working families in the United States and exploring potential policy solutions. As we've heard from the previous speakers throughout the series, today's mothers are working more than they did just 20 years ago, much more. And while the makeup of the needs and related work have changed, work schedules and benefits that are provided to those workers really have not. The market for high-quality and affordable care has also failed to respond sufficiently to the needs of American families. Yet we find that when mothers ask for more flexibility at work, demand the most basic of accommodation when their child is sick and they need to take a paid sick leave day, they're told they're on their own, that it's their choice to have children, and they need to figure out how to make it work. Today's speaker will discuss the challenges that mothers are facing when trying to balance their career with caring for their children, and we'll explore whether these are individual problems or whether it's a cause for government action. So I'll turn it over to Letty to introduce our speaker.
Hi, good morning. My name is Letty Medeiros, and I'm with Irish Women Deloro, and we are delighted this morning to have your award-winning journalist and author and, how do you say your name?
Crittenden.
With us. Her full bio is on the back side of today's agenda. Let me just share some highlights. Her latest book, If You Raise Kids, You Can Manage Anything, received critical praise and was featured in People magazine. Her previous book, The Prize of Motherhood, garnered widespread media attention and was named one of the New York Times Notable Books of the Year 2001. She has written numerous articles for the New York Times, Newsweek, and Fortune. And while at the Times, she initiated numerous investigative reports and is nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. She is also one of the founders of Mothers, Mothers Ought to Have Equal Rights, a grassroots and diverse network of mothers, fathers, grandparents, and other adults who are family caregivers. And on one of her books, I was on the website and saw the reader's response section, just some of the things that people wrote in about your book, The Price of Motherhood. This is a life-changing book. I cried all the way through. One of the readers said, you wrote my soul. And one of them also from Illinois said, until I read your book, I thought it was just me. Thank you for taking the big wheel. Without much more ado, here we have Anne. Thank you for coming.
Thanks so much. I'm really happy to be here. I think probably speaking to the converted in terms of people who support family policy. How many of you, by the way, had attended the other lectures? Did most of you? So, half of you. I didn't think I would dwell on some of the background reasons why we need a stronger family support system, but focus instead. Heather said, why don't we talk about the argument that we hear more than any single other argument against doing more finding public solutions, and that's this choice argument. You do hear this. I heard it so often that I decided to write a chapter about it in my book called It's Your Choice. So with your forgiveness, I'm going to start out reading about four paragraphs from my book on this thing. And you know what I'm talking about. It's this whole thing. Nobody asked you to have a baby. It was your choice to have a baby. If you're having trouble working full-time, getting promoted, making ends meet, finding job care, whatever your problems are, and they are many, it's your problem. It is your choice. So let me just start with one of the ways I go into this. I was listening to a radio show recently, and a woman who had just written a book was being interviewed. She was asked if her life had turned out as she had expected. Oh, no, she replied. I thought I was going to become a professor of literature and the chairman of my department, and then maybe when I was 50 or so, a dean. Instead, basically, I'm a soccer mom. Do you have any regrets? that came the impossible question. At this point, I stopped my car, you know, and sort of, I could imagine her thoughtfully, as if I'm going to say on national public radio with my husband, my children, and who knows who else listening, that I regret what I've done with my life. No, I regret the sacrifices I've made for my children, the woman said. It's been all been more than worth it. So there it is in a nutshell. The cover story. The sideline ambitions. The compromises mothers live with that husbands don't have to make. All justified on the grounds of women's choice. What women choose is so important precisely because women bear a disproportionate share of the cost of childbearing. If they do this willingly, there's no problem. It's their choice. No one made them do it, so no one has to do anything about it. And I'll go on here to these arguments you hear on the liberal side, you hear them from conservatives, you hear them from all kinds of people. And it seems quite reasonable, particularly in our country where the ideology is freedom of choice. But the problem with this, to begin with, is that it assumes that raising a child is just another lifestyle option. One conservative woman economist said, well, there's a guy in my law firm who likes to run marathons. So he goes out, he leaves a little early, he runs the marathon training every day, whatever. And so he doesn't expect, how can he expect to make the same kind of money or the same kind of advancement or partner? Just like having a kid. They have to expect it. But guess what? Maybe raising children isn't just another choice like deciding to be a marathon runner. And if it isn't, if it's more important than that, than running fast, and if female equality is important, then the it's their choice argument is completely inadequate. So that's my introduction to this topic. Let's look at the history, first of all, of this choice argument. You're too young to remember, but I do remember two things. One, I grew up in the South, and this was an argument used about racial discrimination and segregation. It was money is happy. You heard this constantly. Oh, they're happy. The oppressed people are always happy. It takes the guilt. It takes the pressure off the system. That was the argument. It was the same exact argument you heard at the beginning of the women's movement. Well, women don't want to get out in the tough world and compete with men. Real women don't want to do that. Women are happy. You got women on television, you got women out there saying, I'm so happy with the system the way it is. I don't need bank credit. I don't need to work. I don't need to have a decent job. Everybody was happy. That's always the history, the unhappy history of choice. Those who benefit from the status quo, and this today obviously includes those who own and control the media, always attribute inequities to the choices of the underdog. So watch out for that. But choices are never made. So what this all leaves out, of course, is the power context in which choices are made. Choices are never made in a vacuum. To the degree that there is any choice in women's decisions to quit their jobs or scale back on their jobs, accept lesser work and lower income, or have to quit altogether, and that is a problem. Whether the women are working more, but they are still dropping out. I'll get to this in a minute. On high income levels, middle income levels, and lower income levels. Married women, of course, single women have no such choice at all. But anyway, to the extent women are doing this, this choice to stay home is made in an environment that women did not design according to rules that women, and especially mothers, never wrote. Many married mothers, for example, when you do any kind of questioning, any kind of research on this, find out that married mothers would prefer good part-time jobs. Some fathers as well, but overwhelmingly married mothers love the idea of a decent part-time job. That's by that I mean prorated salary, fair salary, prorated benefits, and a prorated, a slower rate of advancement. Just be fair about it. These scarcely exist in the American economy. As one observer of authority on tax said once, we have more choices in breakfast cereal than we do decent part-time jobs in this country. The American labor market basically says to people, it's all or nothing. Flat out, full-time, or not at all. Forget it. And for someone with a primary responsibility for caring for a child or an elderly parent, this is like saying the choice you have is between your right arm and your left arm. lousy choice. So that's not what I call meaningful. And this harsh lack of real choice was documented by a recent study. I had the opportunity to read a manuscript that hadn't come out yet for comment, based on in-depth interviews with 54 professional women in their 30s and 40s who had interrupted their careers to stay at home. And the researcher in Hunter College deliberately chose very high-powered people from top schools who were really on fast track. But they had left their work, and she wanted to know the real reason. The media stories were terribly unsystemic and not accurate, and she wanted to really get at this in a systematic way. Why did these women quit? And I should add, American college-educated women are out of the labor force in greater percentages than in many other developed countries, particularly countries where there are family policies, as in France or Scandinavia. And at this point, I will insert the caveat. It is important, not, I think Heather has stressed, not to exaggerate this phenomenon, because on any long trend line, particularly, I'd say, mid-80s to 2004 or late last data, there's still a continuing upward trend on the participation of mothers, women and mothers in the labor market. And, of course, the higher the education, the more likely they will be to be in the labor market. However, 1 in 4, 22% of white professional women are at home. And that is a significant, that is higher than in many other countries. And considering the efforts and the financial resources it takes to achieve professional status, it's important to get behind the reason we're having this brain drain out of the labor market. Well, what this author found out was that it really was working conditions. That they had quit their jobs only as a last resort. Their stories reveal, in this author's words, a choice gap, a disjunction between what she called the rhetoric of choice and the reality of constraint. Many faced an inability to attain flexibility at work, or if they were able to find it, they were marginalized or stigmatized or encouraged to give it up and go home. And finally, they did. I have one story that came up from mothers, the organization I'm involved in, was asked to provide stories like this for a CBS show a few months ago, and we came up, and they just poured in. And for those of you on Capitol Hill, I'll stress this many, many times, there is a huge silent majority out there that isn't making its voice heard, that for reasons of choice, they say, well, I'll get to that. They just don't want to admit that they're that constrained. It's not in the American idiom to say, I'm a victim, I'm a loser, I have to drop out. They say, well, it was my choice, the way the woman on the radio did. But believe me, they're out there and they're very, very frustrated. This woman's story, she sent us this email. While I can say that the head of our department, she worked in the in a major university in the medical school finance department. While I can say that the head of the department was very flexible with me, and part-time work of 3 days a week was just exactly what I needed. It took 5 years before I was promoted to senior, having done senior-level work since my hire date in April 2000. This was 2006. Typical. You do the work, but you don't get that recognition. Having waited 6 months to be told that a promotion was mine, my immediate supervisor, a very young single male, began withholding work from me. Meetings were held and scheduled on my days off. Excuse me. Projects were assigned to a new employee. And by late September of 2005, I found myself coming into work and looking at a computer screen with nothing on it. My supervisor responded to my concerns with a familiar refrain. If you were full-time, I could do something. Or you have to do what you have to do, but I can't help you. Or you need to think about what's important to you. Followed by whatever. Outright, he discussed how a part-timer could never be a player. Now, considering my children's age and my daily 3.5-hour commute, the not-for-profit pay scale was not keeping me at work. It was the challenge and the interesting work which dried up under their supervisor. Finally, I felt that I had earned and deserved more than the sidelining and closed office door policy that took place. I was heartbroken, but felt I had no alternative but to tender my resignation and stay home. So don't ever think mothers at home are all happy little 50s housewives. There's a lot of people like this woman, hundreds of thousands, I would say, who are not just soccer moms. They are waiting for the system to say to them, we understand, we're going to respond. We care about what has happened to you. So the so-called opting out you read about in the media is really pushed out, edged out, frozen out for professional women. Now, if this is a problem that affects hundreds of thousands, at least, of women, then it's not a personal problem. It is a social problem. It's not an individual problem. It is a community problem, a national problem. It is this widespread, one person can't tackle it. That's a message I always want to give to people in this position. Don't blame yourself, and the system should not write you off either. You've got a problem that's shared across the board. So we need a broader response to it. You need help in solving some of this. It's a problem that reflects a shifting, I think, of the baseline of discrimination. It's a manifestation of a new kind of discrimination, not explicitly based on gender, but based on family responsibilities. We now see women have been in the labor market long enough now to see that we still have advantages, plenty of them, of gender discrimination. But we also have a form of discrimination that could be called discrimination against people with caregiving responsibilities, parents and others with caregiving responsibilities. It is a gender. It's this liability of having to take care of kids, having kids as your obligation. It just so happens that this form of discrimination falls disproportionately on women, and it's severely limiting their opportunities, but it really affects men across the board too, particularly working class blue-collar men. Among all the abundant evidence of parental discrimination, I'll cite just one, which was a recent study you may be familiar with. If anybody talked about Shelley Carroll's study, this is Cornell University, and the researcher posed questions. She took resumes, identical resumes, of women with children and women without children. They were absolutely identical, with the one exception that there were little key giveaways that the woman with children had a couple of kids. They had the same age, same education, same work experience, the whole thing. And guess what? The prospective employer was less likely to hire the one with the kids. If they were asked to look at the resume as a promotion candidate, they were less likely to promote them. And they were less likely to offer them the same salary. And they did it with men, too. And it was interesting because men with and without children did the same. This was not something people held against men, reflecting our cultural assumption that the woman will do most of the work. And the reality, I should add. So there it is. The paper is called Getting a Job Is There a Motherhood Penalty? And it is seriously, it's a big motherhood penalty. Now, if this kind of, all I've said up to now is about educated college graduates, and if it's bad for them, imagine what the situation is like for working class people with very less assets to fight this thing, or the less options to stay home, or no options to stay home. And the media covers this work-family issue as if it were simply the story of upper-income white people opting out of fast-track careers. But this is a huge issue confronting all working-class families, mothers and fathers. Working-class men are particularly affected because a lot of these families have to tag team, have to work different shifts. So one parent can be home at all times because they can't afford it. We don't have enough support for child care. They have to have one parent on the job. So the men are facing, when they're not allowed a day off or a time off for sick leave or whatever, the family really suffers as well. And the men pay the price. The best work on this, again, have you heard about Joan Williams' report?
Yes.
Good. I'm bringing in new material here. Joan Williams runs a work family law center now in San Francisco at Hastings College. And she and her group have looked at 99 actual cases that went to union arbitration over family issues. And they give you the report gives you a very good picture of what's going on in this country with real working families. For example, a bus driver was fired when she arrived 3 minutes late because her severely asthmatic son had had an asthma attack 3 minutes late. A packer was fired when she left work because she had received a phone call that her daughter had had a head injury and was in the emergency room. She was fired early. Many, many cases involve telephone workers who were fired because they were caught calling home to deal with sick children at home, elderly parents with dementia, teenagers involved in selling drugs, suicide attempts. Unbelievable array of problems these women were trying to cope with, and they were fired for making those phone calls to home. They don't have the right. No one in the American workplace has the right to call home. 20% of American families are caring for a child with special needs. There is no law in this country protecting a parent's right or need to provide that care. There is no right to refuse mandatory overtime. I ran into a lot of cases. Two cases like this are in this Price of Motherhood book where the women were so outraged. Most women cannot believe they do not have a right to say, as one woman did who was manager of a computer store, I can't work nights. She was hired 9 to 5. The boss said, you've got to start working nights and Saturday morning. She said, I can't do it. I'm a single mother of a 7-year-old. I cannot not be home at night. You're fired. She just couldn't believe there wasn't a law against this. She took it to the state Supreme Court. She got thrown out. This was in the relatively enlightened state of Massachusetts because there's no law. There is no law in any state that I'm aware of that gives a parent, that protects a parent's parental responsibility. These same people on my end could be sent to jail if something happened to their child while they were at work. So they are in the worst kind of double bind. And that's the legal situation in this country. There literally is no law. And I can go on with countless examples of that. There are others in the William Report. One single mother working as a janitor failed to report one Saturday when her son's caregiver failed to show up because her own child was sick. The janitor had been working 60-hour weeks, solid overtime, for months, and was fired after 27 years of service. So that's what's going on out there. No law against mandatory overtime, which would be a serious, this is really, really needed. Okay, I'll skip some more of these examples, but believe me, the grievances are out there, and the people feeling aggrieved are out there, and I think it's, you know, it could be one of the most popular political platforms known to man and women if the Democrats would get behind it or the Republicans would get behind it, whoever. And believe me, the Republicans are also very beginning to be attuned to this, these issues. I just reviewed two books, one of them written by quite conservative authors who are beginning to write, here's what we can do for working mothers. Working mothers are here to stay, and here's some policies. In my view, these aren't policies that will really help, but they are starting to talk about it. So don't take these women's votes, don't take them for granted. They need some substantive policy. Now, one final word about choice. I'll finish up. I think I'll just make this really quick. And this is very important. We've talked about it up to now, and it's almost always talked about as an individual choice. But a country can, and by the way, of course, it is an individual choice whether or not to have children. And by my guess, many, many women, particularly educated women in America, are choosing not to have children. Our rate of childlessness among educated women is higher than in other countries, any other country, again, that I'm aware of, because we have the least support systems, less support. So we have high rates of childlessness. But that is, in effect, an individual choice that is conditioned by the situation. So people have a choice, but countries don't have a choice. What happens to a country that chooses not to have children? It's rather unthinkable. I mean, the only way it can survive is by opening its doors to all immigration, because that's the only source of future workers and taxpayers will be immigration if you don't have any babies. Now, we all know that's not going to happen. The immigration scenario is not going to work. So the only reasonable, realistic course a country can follow is to support its citizens' efforts to raise children well, so that they do turn out to be good workers, innovative, creative, entrepreneurial, dependable, and all the things that we need in the labor force. So that's why I like to stress that family policy is an economic investment. It's a tough, cold economic investment. There are plenty of studies that show investing in family, investing in human capital, as it's called, it has the highest rate of return of any other investment. Usually these studies are based on education, but when I've talked to the authors, they agree investment in the very first educators, who are the parents, the daycare workers, the child care workers, investing in their skills and in their ability to do their job will have the highest economic payoff we could be making. So it's extremely foolish and extremely short-sighted in sheer economic terms. Forget fairness, forget human justice. It's good economics, and that's what's at stake if, as a country, we really have no choice but to invest in family. So I have a lot more I could say, but I think that will open it up and we'll have a little more to do and take. Thank you.
I have some questions at first, and I'll go through them, and then we'll open it up. In our series so far, we've heard about the problems faced by families trying to achieve balance between their work life and their life at home. In your view, what is the most pressing problem area that we can take back, you know, to the work we do in public policy? Is it the workplace, or is it the need to find adequate care for children, for the sick? You mentioned children with special needs. Or for the elderly, what would you say is the most pressing problem?
Well, that's like asking which arm do you prefer, your right arm or your left arm? Your left arm or your right arm? And which one would you give up? I mean, we obviously need more support for child care, particularly for middle and lower income families. We obviously need more leave time for parents to spend with their children. But I would probably settle on the latter. As a general issue, I would settle on this time question. We in America really are caught in a speed-up. In the 1960s, the United States workers worked fewer hours than many other countries, fewer hours than the Japanese. It was always a joke how hard the Japanese worked and they were going to swamp us and all that. Well, guess what? Now we work longer hours than the Japanese. We work longer hours than anyone else on the face of the earth. By some 2000 data I saw, in two countries, South Korea and the Czech Republic. So American workers are being asked to work longer and longer hours without any family support, without, you know, all the data, no family leave, no sick leave required. This time issue is really destroying. It's destroying people's well-being, their sense of well-being. The stress levels are unprecedented. Medical costs of stress are going through the roof, and I just think that requires some public action. It reminds me of the mid-19th century when we had child labor, we had 80-hour work weeks in factories. We had this kind of situation across the board in the economy. It's crept back in. We've lost the 40-hour work week. Since when do you know of a professional that works 40 hours a week? That's considered part-time now in professional circles. And people who work 40 hours don't get paid fairly because they're considered part-timers. So I think the time thing is we've got to somehow get at that and talk about it more. It isn't, and I've also heard so many comments because this book was translated and, you know, I've talked to journalists from all over the world and almost all of them said to me, I can't believe American women put up with this. We work to live. We don't have to work. And they were so superior about this. many people from around the world just can hardly believe Americans are doing this. So that's a big one. And it is deep. I mean, this is our culture. We have a workaholic culture now, I think. And it's good. It's a strength. But I think, like individuals, your strength is your weakness. The same is true of individuals, same is true of countries. Its strengths are its weaknesses, and our strengths being we're hardworking, we have opportunity, we can be entrepreneurial. These are good things we want to preserve, but the bad part is we are driving people into the ground, and we haven't put in the proper restraint on the employers, I think, to command this kind of performance, these kind of hours.
Great. Now, I think in your books, you make the argument that to stay home and raise the children, whether it's a woman or a man that chooses to do that, they deserve more respect and recognition. And that the laws in our books make women, at this point, more vulnerable by not crediting them with the work they're doing in the family. Can you talk a little more about what happens in other countries? You mentioned some of that. And in your opinion, why is it so different here in the U.S.?
Let's start with the first one. What could we be doing to respect other than work, is what you're saying? Raising the work, I like to say the work of raising children, because it can be a father, it can be an aunt, it can be a grandmother. According to the statistic today, I think there were 28% of grade school kids in Washington being raised by their grandmothers. It could be these grandmothers who are holding up the world. It could be early educators. So all these people are not given their due. They're not given the respect, and they're not given the material rewards that they need. So I like putting our money where our mouth is. Let's give them some resources so they can have a better shot at doing their job. But basically, we need to respect it. How would we show that? Well, first we count it in the GDP. We're the only country, developed country, that doesn't count it. And you say, well, what difference does that make? It would make a big difference, because when you have the GDP accounts, it's been done in Europe, it's mandated in the EU, it's being done now in Australia, with a pioneer in doing it. What they come up with, they found out that the unpaid labor it takes to raise a child, the time it takes, gets close to about 40% of the time spent in paid labor working. It's huge, the magnitude of the time it takes, and we all know it takes more time now than ever to raise a child in the industrial or post-industrial world to prepare them for the economy we now have. So if we knew how much time it took, we couldn't devise policies that ignored it altogether. We couldn't write a welfare bill that didn't talk about child care. I mean, you're going to make mothers work 40 hours a week? Well, single mothers working 40 hours a week? What are you going to do about those children? Put them in the streets? That's what these people are doing when they pass laws like that, without absolutely permissioning care for those children. So counting it is pointless. I think we also ought to reward it. Every other country, developed country, and had many others, have child allowances. We call it welfare and stigmatize it, and now we don't even give it to anybody as a right. But in other countries, you just get an allowance to pay the bills. It's a huge expense. It's an expense in a direct outlay, and it's an expense because one parent usually cuts back on their income to take care of that child. Why not a child allowance to everybody? Don't tell them how to use it. Give them a real choice. They can use it to pay the bills if they're staying at home, or they can pay the more bills if they're working, or they can use it to stay at home, or they can, you know, rent. Everybody does this. Australia does it. What's wrong with that? It's an investment in good care of the future generation. So that's one thing. Another thing, I'm a big fan of also giving Social Security credits for some time spent raising children. It's a national service. You're producing a worker that's going to be a taxpayer. You're producing incredible value for the country. I've done both back of the envelope numbers. What the mother of two kids contributes in terms of future revenues with those children. But what is her credit? You get your Social Security statement of what you're going to expect. For every year you might have raised a child or taken care of your grandchild, you're going to get a fat zero. Zero credit. It breaks them down so that mothers are going to have the lowest Social Security payments of anybody in the society. That's wrong. They ought to get a credit. In fact, it was in the Democratic platform in 2000. Al Gore never mentioned it once, never made a comment about it, much less a speech. But I will tell you that is a very popular policy on the road. When you talk to women about it, if you decide to stay home, you can make a limit on it, make it 2 years, you can make it five, max. Get a little credit toward your Social Security. Don't get a zero. And there's other formulas too. That I know that some conservative think tanks are talking about this, because it appeals across the board. It appeals to conservative women, to
to all kinds of women. We ought to get on board. This is not something that should be assumed. It's not a free lunch, having skilled, trained people in this economy. Somebody's doing the job, and those people deserve recognition. Does that answer?
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you. Just maybe one more question. In your book, you talk about the mommy tax. What is that, and can you elaborate more on that?
Yeah, the mommy tax is a phrase I use to describe what economists call the opportunity cost, the lost income that a person incurs when they move back from full-time work to take care of a child. And this is the pattern in American families. One parent tends to stop working full-time work. Well, about, that's not quite true, about half of families with children under 18, the numbers differ, age 6 and age 18, but basically about half, both parents work full-time, about half part-time or not at all for pay. So it's a big phenomenon in the United States that you don't have full-time labor force participation. And that means that the family income will be very greatly reduced by having a child. In fact, when the Business Week reviewed my book, they led it with the headline, "Welcome to America, where having a baby is the worst financial decision a woman can make, a family can make." Okay, so that's the mommy tax, and it is estimated to be, it's higher here than in other countries, because again, we don't have any supports. We make it hard to stay in your job when you have a child. But it's probably, well, I have some numbers from one paper that if you're two middle-income parents, let's say making roughly $80,000 to $85,000 family income, if one parent decides to be the flexible parent, they could lose $600,000+ a year. I'm sorry, obviously lifetime earnings for having that child. If it's a college-educated parent, the earnings loss easily is over $1 million in lost income. So it is not just a matter of frustration. It's a matter of serious income loss. And it creates poverty in many income groups.
Well, at this point, let's just open it up for questions from here on out. So.
Yeah. Just right here that only 8 states have laws prohibiting discrimination of parents in the workplace.
Sorry?
On the fact sheet.
Oh.
Can you go into detail about what the laws are on discrimination in parents in the workplace?
On discrimination? Well, actually, D.C. has one. Please repeat the question. the question was, can you finally tell the thing out there? The question is, can I say something about the laws preventing discrimination against parents? About 8 states, to my knowledge, have these laws, including District of Columbia. And they basically add, you can do it by simply adding 3 little magic words to the anti-discrimination statute that virtually all cities and states have, which is I shall not discriminate on the basis of race, gender, age, now the debate is sexual orientation, and all of these different things. Why not add parental responsibility to that language of the basic anti-discrimination statute? And what that would do is it provides a legal basis for people to challenge when they are directly confronted with some of the discriminatory practices. I'll give you an example that's in this new book, The Motherhood Manifesto, put out by MUFON co-founder Joan Blades. By the way, MUFON is getting onto these issues, and in their first week of putting some of this on their MUFON site, they had 50,000 sign-ups. So this, I'm telling you, is a grassroots, very powerful grassroots issue. And members really ought to be a lot attuned to that. But anyway, her example, starting out this book, is a woman in Pennsylvania who sold her house in Long Island, moved to a small town in Pennsylvania because she was divorced and this was better. She could get more for her money and then the cost of living would be cheaper. So she did all this and then went to look for a job. Wrong move. She had 11 job interviews. And finally, when the 11th person asked her, "Do you have children?" and then she didn't get the job after she had said yes. When the 11th guy asked her to have children, she said, why are you asking me that? Why is this relevant? I think she was looking for a job as a legal secretary. The guy was very frank. He said, because if you were married, I wouldn't have to provide health coverage for your family. But since you're single and I'll have these health costs, I don't want to hire anybody with kids. Which, by the way, is another very interesting policy thing people don't often connect. If we had universal health coverage, it would be one of the biggest things, family support policies, particularly for single and divorced women. They would have, employers could afford to hire more people if they don't have to pay health care. Getting health care off the back of employers would be a fantastic thing to do for working people, for everybody. So she couldn't believe it wasn't law. So she called her state equal rights commission and all these things and found out that they had no law, only 8 days have. So she, to this day, she finally found work, and this was like years and years ago. She's still working unsuccessfully so far to get this Pennsylvania legislature to have parental responsibility covered in the anti-discrimination. But that's what it's like out there. What about a federal law?
Yeah. When you do ask the question, introduce yourself and say where you're from. Right over there.
I'm sorry,
Mark Lindsay, and I work with Senator Obama. I just had a question about this. You talked some about the legislative and the regulatory side, what might be necessary for the situation. What about the market side, the larger employers? I actually might think that there's some trends that suggest that it's HR analysts and some firms are catching on to the fact that they can still keep employees happy. Where's the role in how public policy will encourage those kinds of trends
There are just countless studies that do show it's economic to offer more family-friendly policies and productivity and retention, lack of absenteeism, and so forth. So there is definitely that argument. And companies have, I think, slowly become a little better about it, in terms, at least in the white-collar field. And there are a lot of examples of good companies. Best Buy has started, you might look at Best Buy, they have a fabulous program that they're trying to start. It's a model, I think, that could spread. So familiarize yourself with these companies as a start and then talking to others. I also heard some interesting information that some other countries have statutes that give parents, let's say in the UK, I believe the statute is that parents with under school age children have the right to opt for a part-time, lower reduced hours work. Now, there's a group in New York called A Better Balance that's just gotten started. It's mostly young attorneys who are trying. We're not going to get a law like that probably in the United States. There's just too much opposition. But they're going to try to. They found out that what really made the law work well in London is they're getting firms together, and this is something somebody like Obama or anybody could try to facilitate. They're getting firms together, and each group wants to start doing this in New York, because some of the firms that are complying with this in London, the very same firms, the brokerage firms, the investment houses that are working in London, try and get them together informally, and let's negotiate, start allowing these reduced hour schedules, that kind of thing. And they're finding that in England, where there's more informal agreement that way, there's more use of the policies than a simple fiat legislation. So that's, facilitating best practice. That's, one thing I can say. Reduced hours is one way, it's one thing you could do with them.
Yeah.
I'm Carolyn Van Dam with the Brown Paper, and I'll start by saying I'm a mother of three who opted out about a few years ago from a vice presidential level career path of a master's degree. I think actually getting buy-in in industry to take these very senior people. They're actually willing to hire their grant writer with, you know, 8 or 9 years of experience and put them in a part-time job. But a lot less likely to hire a former vice president of fundraising to come in and do a part-time job, even though that vice president could probably do the job in half the time, save them a lot of money, and be a lot more effective about it. Some of it, I think, is cultural. It's not us. What we're finding is a lot of the pushback are from career women who have enough to do. Maybe have turned over, maybe have chosen not to have children, maybe have chosen to hand over their child care to the end. For, you know, and I hate to say that about women who represent the labor pool I came from, but we're finding that that
I found that out too. I didn't want to write about it. I hate the dogging dog, mommy word, you know, media thing. So the question is, I'm not sure what the question is, the one I'm going to answer is that there is resistance to hiring mothers, even amongst executive women, often even amongst executive women with children, because they themselves have had to work, you know, these long hours, and they don't understand very human nature. Why, if I had to do it, everybody's got to do it. You found that the Archie Bunker kind of mentality, you know. If I had to work for my son's got to do this. You heard that in the 60s a lot with fathers. But anyway, I heard these stories over and over again. And I think partly it's because a lot of working women expect that maybe the female boss will be more sympathetic. And then they're rudely shocked to discover she's not. Often, again, I think because most organizations are still male designed, male rules written to suit workers who have no family responsibilities, and these successful women have played by those rules, and they take on the coloration of the successful, of the rules that exist. So, although, and I think there is a bit of evidence, though, that when women really control the company, there is more movement in a new model, toward a new model. But we are our own worst enemies in many cases, where there's not much solidarity out there for women. And I have a lot of examples of it in this book because I had to deal with it. One that had to do with Capitol Hill was the welfare bill, where the people on that committee that passed that bill, eliminating the right to welfare, said they were inundated with letters from working class women furious that any woman would be getting benefits that they didn't have. Again, it's a human thing. These hardworking women didn't have health care, they didn't have housing subsidies, they didn't have any allowances. We don't have any of these supports for regular people. So they resented the fact that anyone would be getting them to stay at home. And they enabled these people to vote against welfare. They had that covered. So women have been shooting this. They did the same thing to Zoe Baird, who's very wealthy on the other end of the scale. Piles of hate mail coming in about Zoe Baird. Fired, you know, if you don't remember Zoe Baird, she was going to be Attorney General, but had a problem paying her child care workers proper Social Security, so she got kicked out, and that still penalizes many, many women who are looking at federal appointments. They have one little thing like that in their background, forget it. So we have really sabotaged ourselves on this thing, and I do believe in sticking together, big time.
I'm Deborah Renner. I'm from Parentopia.net, resource for parents. I have a question. My husband is active duty military, has been for 18 years. We get a child allowance. So how come it's so difficult if the U.S. military can find the money to do this? Why is it so difficult to introduce this kind of policy into our larger system so that other families can benefit from this too? You did say that that's something that would be beneficial. Why isn't this getting more attention that way?
Well, we tried. I got a chat little session in this book about it. It's a model system. It's on a sliding scale. The subsidies are greater for the lower enlisted men, and then they go on up, and then at some point they may fail off. I'm not sure. Officers get less subsidy than the enlisted men. But there is a fabulous daycare system. I did an article about it for Government Executive Magazine, so the other departments would know about it. The private sector should, you know, we should have it for the whole country. It works. Although I've been told that in recent years, the Pentagon's trying to cut back on it. The current leadership of the Pentagon is not such a fan of this system. But they need it because they need a huge percentage of people that enlist have children. And they cannot be in the military without help.
The difficult thing is also that, you know, 24-hour child care. Right. The military offers
they also have
24 hours a day, and they don't have 24 hours of child care.
No, and they also have a fabulous system of training child care workers. You're up and out. You have 18-month course you have to take, even if you're just family care people have support systems, they have courses, they take them, they're qualified, and they are paid on government pay scale. So the private sector really, I mean, that's available, by the way. States could use it. All that taxpayer money paid for those training courses. And the states could take advantage of it. They could just say, give us those manuals, and we'll put it in place for our child. But no, they're not doing that. Most of this stuff about child care now is untrained people. We don't treat it like a serious profession that it really is.
And the military does. It's interesting.
Let me, so before I let all of you leave to go have the very best cookies back there, I encourage you all to eat them on your way out. I just wanted to, you know, thank you all for coming, remind you that we have one more briefing, which is going to be on October 8th. And if you sign in today, you'll get a notice about the location and time and all that. I believe it's at 11:30. I believe it's in the basement of the Capitol, but don't trust me. Trust the email. It comes from the person who actually knows. And then, of course, I want to just also recognize and thank again the sponsors, the co-sponsors of these events, which are Representative DeLauro, Maloney, Miller, and Woosley. And then on the Senate side, we want to thank Clinton, Dodd, Kennedy, and Obama for their fine sponsorship of it. And I can see many of the folks in the room from those offices, so we thank you for also coming today. And then one other small little note. Last week, we released a paper on tag team parenting and the difficulties with low-income families in finding that balance in terms of scheduling hours in childcare. And so if you're interested in more information and data on that issue, there's a paper available on our website. Quick plug there. All right, thank you all for coming.